From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the hour ahead, for Dr. Philip Sunshine, holding a baby weighing less than 2 pounds is nothing out of the ordinary. The Stanford doctor has been saving the lives of premature babies for over 50 years. He was one of the first doctors to put babies on ventilators and to let parents spend time with premature babies. When he first started, most premature infants had less than a 50% chance of survival. Today, their survival rate is over 90%. Dr. Sunshine joins us to talk about the changing field of neonatal and developmental medicine after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. As part of our First Person series, which features the local innovators, leaders, and notable characters who make the Bay Area unique, I want to welcome this hour Dr. Philip Sunshine to this morning's second Forum Hour. He's a pioneer in neonatal medicine and co-founder of the California Perinatal Association. Dr. Sunshine came to Stanford in 1957 when the School of Medicine was located in San Francisco. He's a scientist and clinician, and he's been honored with many awards and an endowed professorship at Stanford, and has helped some 30,000 sick and preemie newborns. And we welcome you to the Forum program. Good morning.
Well, thank you. It's great being here.
Great to have you here, and you are a pioneer indeed. We'll try to let listeners know to what degree that is so, but I certainly, in terms of modern neonatology, you have opened many doors, especially when you think about the fact that when you started, the preemie survival rate was under 50%.
It was all based on gestational age and weight. But if a baby, say, if they had, at that time, we called hyaline membrane disease, now it's respiratory distress syndrome, more than 50% of those babies did not survive. And now over 90% of them do survive. And if a baby was less than 28 weeks gestation, they usually weighed less than 1,000 grams. Less than 10% of those babies survived. Incidentally, I did come to Stanford in 56.
Oh, all right. Thank you for
one
that
year.
Correction. We were a year off. Also, though, at that point in time, there was no use of ventilators with newborns. And to a great degree, thanks to you, ventilators were brought in with preemies. Also, I think you were one of the first to feed preemies through intravenous tube.
Well, I wasn't one of the first, but that was there was intravenous nutrition. But getting back to ventilation, there had been several studies or several reports of the use of supportive ventilation in babies who had respiratory failure. The first were from Scotland. One of the authors was a gentleman by the name of Donald, who was an obstetrician, who recommended that they be able to babies could survive with the use of supportive ventilation. And I happened to be working with a very clever gentleman, actually two. One was Vern Thomas, who was an anesthesiologist, and the other was Joe Daly, who was a second-year resident in pediatrics. And they kept saying, we ought to try using supportive ventilation for babies with respiratory failure. And we said, nah, that's too dangerous. And besides, if they survive, they'll probably be horribly damaged. So they put a baby on a ventilator when we were away at national meetings, and the baby survived.
You did this kind of stealthily, in fact.
Yeah, I think when the chairman or when the professors are away, the other people step in and do great things. And that happened, and we became one of the leading groups in providing ventilatory support for babies with respiratory failure, and amazingly had a fairly good outcome.
Is there still concern about overuse of ventilators, though, and possible disabilities? I believe there is, isn't there?
There still is, but I think the techniques of deciding which babies require ventilatory support and the development of the new ventilators, which are really easy to use, I think that the problems that we ran into initially are no longer present. Our big problem is still the very tiny babies who require supportive ventilation can cause lung damage.
It's hard to believe, though, that you had to wait for higher-ups to leave before you could go in and use a ventilator. I mean, sounds like the Middle Ages.
Well, but now it's so routine, everybody uses it.
We're talking again with Dr. Philip Sunshine, who is Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics and Neonatal and Developmental Medicine with the Lucille Packard Children's Hospital. He spent over 50 years in the field and has helped save the lives of 30,000 babies or so. How do you make those counts?
That's a guesstimate. We see how many babies are admitted to our nurseries over the years and divided by the number of years, and that's pretty much how we came to that number.
I should also mention that you were recently named 2015 Legend of Neonatology as an honoree, and congratulations
on
that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I didn't expect that.
Also, it used to be you had to essentially keep preemies in separate rooms, sterile rooms with only doctors in gowns and masks able to come in and hold them. I mean, it's hard to believe that parents weren't allowed in the rooms in many instances.
No. And in fact, when the doctors came in, we had to put on a cap, mask, and gown after carefully scrubbing. And the director of the nurseries in 1964 and 65 was a gentleman by the name of Marshall Klaus. And a very innovative gentleman. And he was primarily a pulmonary physiologist. And we had one baby in our nursery whose father was a resident in radiology. And he would come in at night to dictate his charts. And his mother, his wife, would sit outside the nursery and look in at her baby. Because parents were never allowed to come into our nurseries.
You've got all these studies that say skin to skin and bonding and so forth.
Yeah, well, we thought they'd bring in all sorts of disease. And Marshall said, you know, I'd really like to let that woman come in and take care and see her baby. And the nurses and I say, why don't we let everybody in? And just before that, a doctor up in Washington by the name of Tim Oliver did a study showing that if you came in, the doctors would come in with just washing their hands, not wearing all this paraphernalia. The incidence of infection was not changed. In fact, it was lessened. And then when a very clever psychiatrist by the name of Herb Lederman and an anthropologist by the name of Cliff Barnett heard about this idea, they say, you got to study it. So they set up a very good study where for 4 months, parents were allowed in, and then for 4 months, they weren't allowed in because you couldn't have one parent allowed in, another one at the same time. And they showed at the end of 2 years that the incidence of infection was very low. In fact, it was lower than it had been before. And we thought that there would be very close bonding that you could measure at the end of 2 years. That didn't really show up because humans are very complex. But it did open the nursery to parents. And initially, they'd have to come in with cap, mask, and gown and things. After a while, we just had them come in. And now, every nursery is family-oriented, where families can come in and be with their babies, listen to rounds as you plan for their baby's care, and are intimately involved in the decision-making as to what's going to happen with their baby.
Now, I may be off by a year again. Correct me if I am. But I believe before 1968, healthcare didn't even cover newborns. It was an NIH grant that changed things, yeah?
Well, it changed it. In 62, we did get a grant from the National Institutes of Health that's called the Clinical Research Centers. And my chairman at that time was Dr. Norman Kretschmer, who really pushed the NIH to set up a clinical center to study preterm babies. So that opened up. But the insurance did not come in. Babies were not covered unless they were in a research center or something like that. But no insurance companies covered the care of newborn infants. And the only coverage was through, at that time, called Crippled Children's Services of California. Now it's called Children's Medical Services. And if a baby was born with a congenital defect, they could possibly be covered. But if it was just a preterm baby or a sick baby without these problems, no insurance policy covered them. And not only that, but in order to be covered, the baby would have had to be discharged from the hospital and then be readmitted for care. And in 1967, under the urging of a pediatrician by the name of Leo Bell, who was subsequently passed on, worked with Yvonne Brathwaite Burke, and they instituted a policy in the state of California that any company offering insurance had to cover the newborn. And it took a couple years for this to get going. But she had the insurance companies write the bill so there would be no loopholes. And it really changed the way that babies were cared for.
How do you think the changes where babies are cared for are going to accrue in light of the Affordable Health Care Act?
Oh, I think it's improved it. Of course, you know, I'm very liberal, and I've always thought the affordable health care, except for a few problems that can be ironed out over a period of time, has been a godsend to so many people in our country to get coverage where they didn't have it before.
And in fact, Lucille Packard Children's Hospital has been dedicated to a lot of that coverage for the years. Yeah.
Well, we care for all babies, whether they have insurance or whether they don't. We still Medi-Cal. Our patients who have Medi-Cal make up about 55 or 60% of our patients, and then there's No-Cal. This is what we call where he had no insurance whatsoever. So we care for all of these infants. And now with the Affordable Care Act, pretty much every baby has some form of coverage.
You've been generously mentioning a lot of the people who were involved in some of this pioneer work along with you. There's a name, Louis Gluck, who plays a pretty central role.
Yeah, he's an amazing man. He was the first head of newborn medicine when Stanford moved down from San Francisco to Palo Alto. And he made taking care of babies so much fun. He pointed out so many things I had never even heard of in babies. And he only lasted a year at Stanford before he moved on to Yale and then to Miami, University of Miami. Ended up in the University of California, San Diego. And he was a pioneer in many regards. And he and his group at all of these centers were instrumental in bringing forth new ideas in the care of preterm babies.
Can you talk about, I keep calling you a pioneer, but there was a metabolic disorder that you were involved in the discovery of, I believe.
I wasn't. This entity had been reported, and we were fortunate enough to recognize this in a child who had a disease called ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency, OTC for short. And without care, most of these children died or were horribly handicapped. And we were able to find the young girl who had this disorder, and we recognized it early and were able to get her on a diet that allowed her to grow and develop and into a fine young lady. But we did miss the boat we had a family of infants, newborn infants, males who had this disease and who would have seizures and die in the newborn period. And we were at a loss to explain this until somebody at Yale reported that this disease can occur in males, in newborns, and unless you treat them carefully and rapidly, they will not survive.
Again, our guest is Dr. Philip Sunshine, Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics in Neonatal and Developmental Medicine and the honoree in 2015 of Legend of Neonatology. You know, you're still at it. I mean, as I understand it, in fact, working about 30 hours without night calls.
Without night call.
Right, and that's a very important distinction. But also, doing it a little bit differently than you did all these years, now mainly in the step-down nursery, what they call
correct,
the step-down
yes,
nursery?
Correct, yes, we call it the step-down nursery. These are babies who had been critically ill and who now are no longer requiring intensive care but are not ready to go home yet. So they still need to learn how to nurse and how to feed and how to grow. And it's a unit that is low-key, and the young neonatologists find it rather boring. So I do all the stuff the young people don't want to do.
You still mistaken for the night janitor when you were there at night, at least? I understand, you know, your dress and lots of keys had you sometimes mistaken for a guy who was there with custodial duties.
Well, I used to have a lot of keys because there were a lot of doors that needed opening. Our offices were at a distance from the nursery. And they used to hang out of my pocket. And one of my coworkers described me as looking like the Polish janitor working at night.
And this is when you drove that Dodge Dart?
I drove the Dodge Dart for over 20 years, right?
Over close to 300,000 miles.
Too. Yes.
Yeah. Learn all kinds of things about guests we have on here, as you can tell. But I'm also interested in learning from you about what your attitude may be about home births. This still remains an ongoing controversy, and many who say, especially with the possibility of having a premature infant, should be in the hospital.
Well, I've always felt very strongly about this. I'm sure there are situations where home births are perfectly plausible and where the woman, the mother, has gone through an uncomplicated pregnancy and all care can be provided at home, and I'm sure this works out quite well. However, there are so many unexpected things that can happen, and unless you have all the equipment available, it's not a good idea to have home births. One of my coworkers, or I should say coworker, but a gentleman by the name of Joe Butterfield, who was a classmate of mine and who ran the nursery at Denver Children's Hospital for years, always had a little pin that said home deliveries are for pizzas only.
Well, of course, there are those who say midwifery is very advanced and, you know, midwives know what they're doing and they bring in doulas now and all sorts of professionals, really, who in some ways depart from traditional medicine and yet seem to fulfill in many people's minds what they want, which is, I'm going to have this birth at home.
I think that works out well. I would say to over 90%+ of those patients have no problems, and it works out well. Everybody's very happy with the situation. They're at home, father's involved, nurse midwife is experienced, but every now and then there's going to be a catastrophe that is unanticipated. And those are the babies that we see, so we're getting a very biased view of home births in that particular situation. We don't think it's a good idea for preterm babies to be delivered at home. I don't think it's a good idea for multiple births to be delivered at home.
But fathers are involved now for the most part. I mean, you remember the day. In fact, I remember the day when fathers were – a friend of mine, former colleague of mine, was the first father to go into obstetric ward and see his child born at Kaiser Hospital.
Well, now
it's
they're –
in the early 70s.
You know. Now they're encouraged to come in. Well, our first child was born in 1962, and I, of course, being a physician, stayed with my wife. And it was a very interesting experience because the anesthesiologist came in and gave her a caudal anesthesia, which was the primary pain reliever at the time. And then she started to have shivering. And I checked her blood pressure, and it was 70 over like 45. Her blood pressure was usually running in the 110s or 120s. And I ran out and called the nurse. I says, you have to get the anesthesiologist here because my wife's blood pressure is dropping. And she says to me, why are you taking her blood pressure? I said, I don't care. Just get the anesthesiologist.
We're talking with Dr. Philip Sunshine, who is wearing, by the way, a tie with it's a solar tie. There are suns and sunglasses on the suns, actually. It's a kind of a brand, I suppose, tie in many ways, or a signature tie made by his daughter when she was, what, 7 years old?
Yeah, she came up with the idea when she was about 7 years old.
Yeah. And we should mention there are midwives at many hospitals now, of course.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, just not to separate, as it used to be often, midwives at home only, or midwives even exclusively or largely at home. You mentioned your wife's experience, there are some who feel, you know, that drugs should be avoided at all costs with birth and that cesareans are performed too often. I mean, this is a little bit out of your bailiwick, but how do you come down on those two things?
Well, we've been involved in a lot of the discussions about this. as far as the drugs being used, it's amazing how women now are so sophisticated, they really don't want to use any drugs. And as far as pain medication is concerned, they really like to limit the amount of pain medication they require. The thing that's been great is the development of epidural anesthesia. Mm. And the women's pain – initially – it was thought that this would delay labor. It really hasn't proven that way. But it takes away all the pain. And we have sessions at Stanford where newly parents who were going to deliver their first babies or so come and they get instruction, or they ask questions about all sorts of things that happen in the delivery room. And the main thing they want to know is, can they get an epidural? And they ask the anesthesiologist, they say, how early can we get the epidural? He says, well, I can meet you in the parking lot.
Epidurals have certainly changed a lot of the terrain here. I remember my sister once saying, I think it was her first pregnancy. I want them to wake me at the hairdressers. it's really another era that we're
That's
talking
right.
about and all those changes. But what about cesareans? I mean, there's still a sense that too many are performed.
Well, this is a problem because I think the biggest issue was sort of the elective cesarean sections. And sometimes the timing was not absolute, so that some of these babies were delivered prematurely rather than at the time they were supposed to have been delivered. And then there was this period, if you have a section, always a section, that you don't go back to a vaginal birth after a cesarean section. It's called VBAC. And people then start writing about the success of VBACs. And then they say, well, you can have a VBAC even if you have multiples. And ran into a lot of problems with VBACs, especially if you were in a hospital that didn't have immediate care for the newborn. So if you had an anesthesiologist available, pediatricians available, that if something happened, and the most common thing that could happen is rupture of the uterus, then the mother can be saved. But if you go for a period of time with the baby being in a hypoxic or anoxic, in other words, with low oxygen or without oxygen, you end up with a severely damaged baby.
Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking with Dr. Philip Sunshine, who has been saving lives of premature babies for over a half century. And Stanford doctor is talking with us about the changing field of neonatal medicine. We're getting a lot of the history here because he's lived a lot of it. He's professor emeritus of pediatrics in neonatal and developmental medicine with the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, and also was recently named 2015 Legend of Neonatology as an honoree. If you'd like to join us, you're welcome to do so now. Our toll-free number is available, and we do invite your involvement in the program with any questions or comments. You can join us now, toll-free at 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program and the conversation. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. If you'd like to join us again, please feel free to do so now. We'll take your calls and emails when we return. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to a Bay Area doctor who is still defining neonatal care after 50 years, Philip Sunshine, MD, with us in studio, professor emeritus of pediatrics in neonatal and developmental medicine for many years at Stanford, and also with the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, and a new Legend of Neonatology honoree. We want to bring you into the conversation here. Some of you probably have some tales to tell of neonatal experiences or experiences with preemies or, for that matter, newborns in general. And for those kinds of stories, we welcome your phone calls or any questions or comments you might have for Dr. Sunshine. We also welcome your phone calls as well. The number to call is 866-733-6786. And if you'd like to join the program, there are other ways to do so. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Looking at some emails that have just come in, Natalie writes, God bless you. I was able to spend time in NICU with our son that was priceless. I fed him breast milk and held him, sang to him. I always will cherish that time. I'm sure you hear that a lot. Tim writes, I am a blood donor for Blood Centers of the Pacific and normally donate whole blood. Last week, a donation screener told me I should donate blood plasma or blood platelets for neonatal babies. Can Dr. Sunshine talk about what role the blood donation of plasma or platelets play in this work?
We use both of those in the donations. And, of course, they can spin off the red blood cells. They call them packed red blood cells. And for the babies, they usually take a full unit and divide it into what we call preemie packs that have maybe 25 to 50 cc's, and then spin off the plasma and the platelets, which then can be stored and used not only for preemies, but can be used for pediatric patients and even adult patients. So there's just very many ways that the blood can be processed to get maximum utilization.
Let me just read a few more emails, and then we'll get to the listeners' calls. Tri writes, I want to thank Dr. Sunshine for saving my fraternal twin daughters' lives. Also, special thanks to Dr. Drusen and the unsung heroes of the Stanford Lucile Packard Children's Hospital NICU, the nurses. My twin daughters were born at slightly over 28 weeks of gestation, weighing under 3 pounds and 4 pounds. They are now healthy, intelligent, and growing four-year-olds in preschool. Peter in San Carlos says, what an inspiration to have such a gracious guest who goes to such length to mention all his colleagues in medicine and research, but how does he remember all those names?
At my age, that's a good question.
Yeah, you're an octogenarian. It is a good question. It's just everything's working okay for the
so
most
far.
Part. Yeah, touch wood. Formica here. David writes, I have two questions. The first is, what are the outcomes of these premature children into adulthood with regard to physical and mental capabilities? And the second is, why should society spend tremendous assets to assure survival of these children rather than spend the same assets on children who do not have the physical and mental disabilities that often accompany premature birth? Are there enough people on the earth already?
That's a loaded question. We were concerned about this from the very beginning when we first put babies on ventilators and tried to provide intensive care. It turns out that if the baby is born, initially we felt that 28 weeks, where there had been a 10% survival and now it's over 90% survival, almost all of those children, unless they have other major problems, are going to survive and develop into normal and useful individuals. The thing that we're worried about is the lower end of the spectrum. I feel that any baby born at between 25 and 26 weeks of gestation will have a decent chance of survival and also survive intact without having a burden on society. What my major concern is, as we're getting down to the lower end of the spectrum, and babies at 22 weeks, 23 weeks, 24 weeks are surviving, and many of these incidents of survival is as high as 50%. But a significant number of these patients are handicapped and are a burden not only on their families, but on society.
You say significant, like what kind of percentage?
Well,
it
can be as high as 50 to 60, and sometimes in a very low low gestational age, it can be even greater. And we take care of these babies, we get them to survive, we're discharged from the hospital, but then the parents have to take care of these patients, of their children, for a long period of time with severe cerebral palsy, intellectual, other neurological handicaps, and this becomes a burden on society. It's an anecdote, but my son is in practice as a family practitioner in a town called Foothill Ranch near Laguna Beach. One of his patients is a woman whose son is severely handicapped, and every time she comes in, she mentions this to my son, your father saved my child, but they didn't tell me that this is going to be a horrible outcome.
Appreciate your candor on that score. Let me go to our callers. Stephen, you're on first here. Hi.
Oh, good morning, Michael. Good morning, Dr. Sunshine. Thank you for the show. I was born in 1962. I was 2 months premature. I was born at Marin General Hospital. And my question really has to do with some of the potential psychological effects of, because I think I was in the hospital for like 6 to 8 weeks before I came home is what I recall my mom telling me. And I'm one of 6 kids, but I've always been kind of very comfortable being by myself and almost having a need to be by myself, even though I'm very social. And I was wondering if there was any sort of documented stuff about the psychological effects of being, in the hospital for that period of time at such an early age. And also, Doctor, your laugh is as your surname. It's wonderful.
Thank you. I wish I could give you data regarding that particular question that you brought up. We do know that if you take and do psychological studies and do IQ testing on babies who are prematurely born versus their sibling controls, which we've done on several occasions, there is an increased incidence of having a lower IQ, sometimes as much as 8 to 10 points. We also find that some of the children, some of the preemies who have grown into adulthood have different lifestyles than their siblings. And they may have, even if they don't have intellectual or neurological impairment, they may act differently than their siblings. I remember doing a study way back when, this had to be in the mid-70s, where we had siblings in and very, very brilliant parents. And the preterm child, baby that was born preterm, had an IQ score that was about 10 points less than that of her normal sibling. And the father was concerned about this, and the mother looked at him and at me and said, "Who is happier? Which one of these kids you think is happier? My preemie is the happiest little kid I've ever taken care of." And so there can be all sorts of terrible problems, but even if there is some minor issues, I think most of the preterm patients seem to adjust quite well. As far as being shy and things like that, in other families that have six kids, they're not all outgoing and exuberant. You might find different social makeups in that particular family as well.
It's not only preemies, though. Let me thank Stephen for the call. When I was 7 years old, I went in for a hernia operation, and the day I was supposed to be operated on, I had a cold. And again, it was the way they used to do things in those days. I was put in isolation. Only nurses with face masks came in to see me. My family couldn't see me and so forth. And this went on for a week. And, you know, it was somewhat traumatic. I mean, those kinds of things do have impact on a child. It's hard to measure how or quantify it with preemies. But as you grow up and as you become more aware of your surroundings, I would think that, you know, being alone like that and isolated like that certainly had an effect on me. I know it did.
Well, I'm sure that's true. I had the same situation. I was hospitalized on a contagious disease ward at Denver General Hospital when I had scarlet fever. And I was there for, I think, 3 weeks and in a room by myself. Everybody came in, had cap, mask, and gown. And I didn't see my parents that whole time. I don't know if that had a bad effect on me, but I think I survived it.
Who knows about these effects? We'll take another caller. Mindy, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have many cross connections to this conversation, so I really appreciate you having this this morning. I'm a professional child birth educator and doula, and I'm a home birth mom. I was also born premature, so I'm a lot of different cross connections. Anyway, I just wanted to comment on your conversation earlier regarding prematurity and home birth and the appropriateness of it. I know many home birth midwives in the Bay Area here will not see when the baby is premature, they always would transfer to a hospital or have a tertiary care that would support this more of an abnormal situation versus what, you know, midwives would turn as a normal birth would occur after 37 weeks. Just within their professional care.
Dr. Sunshine.
Oh, I missed the gist of that.
I think she's saying that home births, if there's a likelihood of a premature birth, that things will move to the hospital.
Yeah, I think that's true. Anyway, I don't think that there is a movement. I agree with you completely. I think that I think the midwives are certainly knowledgeable and are capable of recognizing when there is something going on in labor, and especially if it's a preterm birth. I think they have the judgment to have that mother deliver in the hospital.
And we thank you, Mindy, for your call, and we go right to another caller. Jesse, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a comment and a question, and thank you for taking my call. My comment is I was born a little bit early as a twin in 1962, and I really wish Dr. Sunshine was around then because my sister didn't survive it. I bet she would have if she had such a great doctor. And my question is, refers to home birth. I had a home birth after having an emergency C-section, and then I had another home birth that followed that, and they were quite healthy. And my concern was mainly having too much intervention at the hospital and also iatrogenic bacteria. And I just was wondering if the doctor could comment on the kinds of super bacteria that occur in hospitals. And I'll take my answer on the radio.
Okay. Thank you for the call.
I agree with the concern that, you know, going into the hospital, you're exposed to a lot of organisms that can be resistant to many antibiotics. And this is a concern that people who would like to have home births have. They don't want to go into the hospital and be exposed to these unnecessarily. I think it took a lot of courage that after you had a cesarean section that you had a vaginal birth at home. I think this is a little worrisome, but I think if you have proper management during labor by an experienced midwife, that you probably would have been able to go through this labor and delivery in very good shape. It's just that there are times when things do occur and you have to be prepared for catastrophic events. My friends, the obstetricians, including Dr. Drusen, who was mentioned before, note that an obstetrician's life is quite easy. Most of the babies are delivered without difficulties, but there's always a small group, and it maybe is 5 to 10% where there's something that can happen that requires emergency response and emergency thinking. And this is why if you're at it delivered at home and things go wrong, you may not be able to get to intensive care or the needed care as quickly as you would if you were in the hospital.
And again, we're talking to Dr. Philip Sunshine, and our next caller is from Alameda. Mary, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. Hi. I gave birth to a son in 1989 at Stanford, 1 week after the earthquake, and another in 2005 at UCSF. And they were both about the same amount premature at 32 weeks. And it's really interesting to me how much the care had advanced. The first child had blood samples taken for oxygen measurement, and then in 2005 that was no longer necessary. So in 1989 we were worried about the safety of the blood transfusions. It was just really amazing to me how much it had advanced, and of course both boys had wonderful outcomes.
Well, I'm glad to hear
that. That was my comment.
Yeah, glad to hear it too, Mary. Thank you.
I'm glad that they did well. It's interesting because I think the advance that had been made was that we no longer have to draw blood really for measuring the blood gases, the PO2, PCO2, and over a period of time we've relied primarily on measuring oxygen saturation, which is putting an electrode on the toe or the finger. And we do not have to measure the blood gases as frequently as we had before. Also, in the probably in the late 90s, we started to recognize that we were giving too many blood transfusions to preterm babies. We did not allow their hematocrits to drop below 30%. Now we recognize that the babies can tolerate lower hematocrits. And unless the baby is symptomatic, having difficulty with respiration or showing other signs of anemia like rapid heart rate, we do not transfuse those babies until they reach very low levels like in the low 20s hematocrits. And we find that the babies then regenerate the blood cells with the use of giving them iron and monitoring them. So the number of blood transfusions that we use in our nurseries now has plummeted.
Our guest is Dr. Philip Sunshine, and he's part of our first-person series here on Forum. I want to read some listener comments. This is a listener who writes, be careful with your hospital statistics. Our daughter was born at Lucile Packard and lived 2.5 hours. While she fits nicely in your statistical description of what is now a typically good outcome, each child is different and there is both happiness and tragedy in premature births, which I think Dr. Sunshine has outlined. But this listener goes on to say, while I grant that there have been wonderful advances in healthcare and that mortality rates are improving, premature birth is quite a challenge, and that even when the baby survives, there are often many long-term consequences, which, as I said, I think you pretty much established. Let me read some more emails here. Janet writes, our son was one of 30,000 saved by Dr. Sunshine. He's 26 and healthy. I'm grateful that he ordered the nurses to allow me to nurse our son with bare skin-to-skin contact, tubes and all. The bond formed at that time, stayed strong, and endures to this day. And by the way, my day in the NICU always began well just by saying Dr. Sunshine. As you can hear, his very voice speaks sunshine.
Thank you.
Marcia writes, is your guest aware of either Dr. Heidelis, Al's work, Second Womb, or Dr. Niels Bergman's work, Kangaroo Mother Care? If so, can he comment as to whether or not these programs are in hospitals he works in, and is he aware of the prematurity prevention campaign, and can he speak to that as well?
Well, I can speak. Heidi Alls, of course, said was one of the people who advocated it's not exactly kangaroo birth, but similar to that, where the babies are kept in a very enclosed environment in an incubator, wrapped warmly and sort of
like a pouch,
as they were in utero. And her work has acquired a lot of comment. I think it's very, very helpful in many babies. The babies who have lots of apnea and or they stop breathing or have other difficulties, it's better if they sort of lie in an incubator without being bundled or closely held.
Well, and there's some sound coming in here. I'm not sure what that's all about. But this idea of, going back to the second womb, I mean, I think it was Samuel Beckett who said he remembered being in the womb, but most of us don't. And there was for a while this whole idea in psychoanalysis that you wanted to go back to being in the womb, and there was that desire and so forth. So I guess this is kind of in line with that.
Well, yeah. So Heidi Alls, there are a lot of people who don't agree with her. We call that NIDCAP care, neonatal. I've forgotten all the words that make up that. But when the baby's having difficulties, I'd like them to be in the incubator so we can monitor more closely by vision, not only by electrodes, and also we'd like to have the families take care of a baby skin to skin. I just want to comment one other thing that the previous caller mentioned was the ability to breastfeed her baby and nurse her baby. We have always advocated, as far back as I can remember, the use of mother's milk to nourish the baby rather than using formulas or other or formulas, and have encouraged us because we find that it gives the babies, they have less incidence of intestinal disease, especially a devastating disease called necrotizing enterocolitis. And the nursing staff at our hospital and many other hospitals are so much, they're advocates of bringing in milk for their babies that they just encourage it. And I would say that over 80% of the preterm babies that we take care of go home on mother's milk.
Well, I'm all for mother's milk. But what do you make of some of the arguments and criticism of groups like La Leche that they make it go too far? You know, there should be a cutoff point earlier than I see.
It's true with anything that's almost religiously driven. But when a mother says, what can I do to help my baby? The first thing I tell her is, please bring us in as much milk as you possibly can. And we do encourage them because I think it's so much more healthy for the baby than having to give them formula. Some parents can't do it. They just are not able to produce the amount of milk. They may have other interests. And we recognize that and we say, fine, this is great. You're going to be a great mother. You know, we'll help you take care of your baby and things like that without giving them the guilt complex that they can't produce milk.
Another listener named Jack writes, it would be appropriate to mention the advancements in neonatology achieved at UCSF, such as the development of CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure, which preceded the use of mechanical ventilation, and the development and clinical use of pulmonary Surfactant in neonatal respiratory distress syndrome?
I think that's a really important question. First of all, CPAP came in after the we had been using ventilator therapy. And the people at UCSF at the time were not as successful using ventilation as some other centers. But then Dr. Gregory, Phibbs, Thule, I'm leaving out some names, and Hamilton came up with this idea of using continuous positive airway pressure, have the baby breathe out against the resistance. And this has changed the entire way that people have provided ventilatory support for babies. Every ventilator that's been developed since that time has a component of continuous positive airway pressure. And this was a major, major advance in the care of preterm babies. UC has come up with a lot of other innovations. They were the first, thanks to Dr. John Clemens, who is a biochemist and who characterized the makeup of the surfactant proteins in lungs, developed synthetic surfactant material called Exosurf. And Exosurf given to preterm babies who had hyalomembrane disease, respiratory distress syndrome, improved their outcome considerably. After that, Dr. Furukawa, who trained with the physicians at UCLA, came up with a better surfactant material to replace for these babies. And variations of that material are being used primarily in babies today. But the contributions that UCSF has made over the years has been phenomenal with superb clinicians and teachers. And in fact, one of the early heads of their nursery, Dr. William Thule, a dear friend of mine, came down and spent a great deal of time with me when I became the director of nurseries at Stanford, teaching me how to run a nursery, how to deal with problems. And I always thought he was one of the most magnificent individuals I've ever met.
You were talking before about breastfeeding. Jane writes, at a time when Phil came to Stanford, less than 20% of mothers were attempting to breastfeed. Phil was the go-to guy for using human milk in the NICU. Can you ask him a little bit about how this has become the norm and especially important in this group of vulnerable infants?
Well, I've always felt it was very important because human milk has a great advantage. As I mentioned, it provides all the immunoglobulins that the baby needs. Even if it's frozen, we lose very few of those. And I've always very felt strongly about it. I have to tell you an anecdote, which will take another minute. But we had this one baby that was about 6 months old that had intractable diarrhea. And nothing we gave the baby seemed to help that infant. He was just sort of wasting away. And the father said, why don't we try some human milk and see if it works? I says, it will never work because it's too much milk sugar in there, lactose. But we tried it, and suddenly the baby got better. And that was the first time that this baby started to have normal stools. And so we didn't have enough milk through the milk bank, so I put out a plea to the newspapers for parents to bring in milk. And my wife was at home, and she got a call. And he says, this is Dr. Linus Pauling, and I'm working with a firm that's making synthetic nutriments. And I wonder if your husband could call me and I could discuss it with him. He says, the name is Pauling, P-A-U. My wife says, I know how to spell it.
And it needs vitamin C. Did he add that? Wow, that's a great anecdote. You know, you're getting some wonderful emails here, people who have had experiences with you, who are praising you, who are also professional colleagues of all sorts. But here comes in some criticism from someone who writes, adds a PS that listening to two men discussing home births with no woman present is a bit off-putting, but writes in the heart of the email, with the huge unmet need for basic medical and dental care in this country, the spending of these funds is extravagance. I get that desperate parents will do anything to save their one baby. I also get that doctors want to find new ways of doing things. I am not sure, however, that we can or should afford it.
Good question. Don't have a great answer.
Right. Well, on home births, let me, since she was disappointed, let me get a woman on here to talk about home births. Anne, hi.
Hi. I I just had my first child, Quinn, and luckily the story is a happy outcome, but I just wanted to say that my husband and I considered a home birth. We watched the documentary, The Business of Being Born. We have a wonderful OB, Dr. Jan Ridfors, and Dr. Ridfors said, "Ann, please don't have a home birth," and so we didn't, and I'm so glad that we listened to Dr. Ridfors, because when our son was born, I had a completely normal pregnancy. I went into labor at 40 weeks and 4 days. And when he was born, the umbilical cord was wrapped twice around his neck. And he had to require emergency medical treatment. Within 2 hours of being born, he was transferred to Lucile Packard and had a 3-day cooling treatment. Luckily, his MRI, like 4 days later, showed that everything's normal. And I'm looking at him in the rearview mirror of the car. He's a beautiful, happy baby, totally healthy. But I just want to urge all of your listeners that we had a wonderful doula. Her name was Michelle from Stork.
I'm sorry, we've come to the end of the hour here, Ann, but I thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Appreciate you being with us, Dr. Sunshine. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. I'm sorry I should be talking about home births because I don't deliver babies.
That's okay. You're a pediatrician. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.